Hey everybody, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for 8 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures and are learning how digging into God's word has helped us grow deeper with each other and those around us.
We want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper. Finally, welcome back. Last time we did this podcast, it's easy for me to remember because it was the day that Sadie got hit in the head with a golf club.
That's right.
By Caleb.
Yeah.
So it's been like, I think 3 weeks, maybe three weeks and a day or something. So sorry about that. we got sick except for Garrett because Garrett went out of town for work and, I cuddled with the sick children for like a week and got sick. So it's been a little bit. And then sometimes you're just,
Not necessarily feeling it.
And we want to be feeling it when we record a podcast.
Yeah. So. We don't want to be faking it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So here we are, back again and doing another, this is also like the weird thing is like, these have been some of my favorite chapters of Exodus.
Yeah.
And we've been very spaced out with doing the podcast, but they truly are some of the best chapters of the story.
And I actually think 34 is the climax of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think everything for the whole book has been leading up to Exodus 34.
Yeah. So I know it feels like we're slowly chugging along, but we are going to be really speeding up the pace, I think, with our next podcast.
Well, just think of how long we've been in Exodus.
Yeah.
Me and you. I mean, like, when we started, when the pandemic started and stuff, we were doing maybe Ruth or...
Oh, I don't remember specifically.
I think, well, it may have been actually we were doing some of those minor prophets. But I mean, like, we've been doing Exodus for like...
A while.
A year now, I feel like.
I mean, there's just been a lot of, I don't know, like going so slowly through it, though, has really caused me to reflect on it and like... Just, I don't know, I've had a lot of aha moments as we've studied Exodus, and so that's been actually kind of exciting. Like, I feel like my eyes have been opened in a new way, where it's like they were peeking open with some of the, like, minor prophets and other other Old Testament books we were doing, but this has just really, like, I'm seeing how it's woven throughout Scripture.
Yeah.
How it's all...
Well, and that was part of why I wanted to do this book anyways, was because... All of the rest of the books depend on this one.
Yeah.
So, or have it interlaced into it. And until you know this story intimately, it's really hard to, like, you won't pick up on that. But then once you've read it, now, you know, I think those things will start echoing whenever you read other books.
Yeah.
So I think that's why, this book is, I mean, for Jewish people, I mean, they read the Torah once a year. You know, they read through it out loud every year, once a year. You know, it's taken us a year to get through Exodus.
Yeah.
Like, but this is something that is just known. This story is told and retold over and over again, and it's like woven into their hearts, you know, mm-hmm. of who they are. So, it's good for us to do the same.
Yeah.
So
before we jump in, of course, we have to do another Chick-fil-A kids.
Table topics.
Roulette.
I had to read it.
Oh, but yeah, I know I slid it over so I could remember what it was called.
Yeah.
Of course, we add the roulette. So Garrett,
I don't think they put roulette on the kids thing at Chick-fil-A.
No.
Okay. How would you decorate a surfboard if given the chance?
I think I know how you would.
Well, how do you think I would?
Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I was actually thinking that. I was like, I would put Lord of the Rings stuff. I would have a Tree of Gondor on there. That would be a great tattoo if it wasn't so incredibly nerdy of the Tree of Gondor. I mean, because we've talked about tattoos before, and I just like dream of like cool tattoos, and I'll never get them. But I'll get some. I'll get
you
one
never
at some
know.
Point.
You never
but
know.
It, yeah, the, I think the Tree of Gondor would be a great tattoo. I think. And so to go on a surfboard, I think, would be perfect, too. I don't know what else, what other, like, inscriptions from the Lord of the Rings, but that would be, I've been thinking about decorating the office, my office with Lord of the Rings stuff. also, and you know, so I don't know. I like the random artistry and stuff from the Lord of the Rings. Well, I like everything about the Lord of the Rings. So
there's nothing I don't like about
the there's Lord really not much I don't like about Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
So I yeah, I would say my surfboard would have something to do with that.
Yeah.
So yeah. Anyway. Okay, your turn.
I'm glad I didn't get that one because yeah. I don't really know what I would do. Who would make a great teammate? He's sitting right here. He already does.
Don't flatter me. Who outside of me would make a great teammate?
Outside of you? Well, I mean, my instinct goes to my mom.
Okay. Wow. So you went like really emotional on that.
Emotional.
Well, I mean, like, well, I mean, you know,
what are we talking about? A teammate for what? Because I'm thinking a teammate for life.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean. Well, like for sports or like just a random games, I'd probably say my brother, Jeff, because he is like kind of just like really good at like anything he tries, mm-hmm. like random sports, you know, like it, things that you don't necessarily think of as, you know, yeah, I'm talking about like spike ball or tennis
random things to just pick up.
Ping pong or, you know.
Sure.
I mean, he's good at, I guess, regular sports too. But I mean, like, those are just, if you're talking about like a game,
mm-hmm.
it seems like he picks up stuff really quickly.
I feel like most of the time in games, I feel like I always just end up becoming the villain for everybody. Like, I'm supposed to take.
Well, see, okay, so like with card games and stuff, I'm not super great at them. I don't think through. You know, like, I'm just, usually by the time I'm playing a card game, I'm, like, so worn out from the day. Because that usually is a nighttime thing, I feel like. And so I just don't have the, like, brain power to try to figure out how to win.
Mm-hmm.
So my goal then becomes just to take you down. So I team up with anyone we're playing with. And the goal is to, as long as Garrett doesn't get first, I basically feel victorious.
Well, even if it's like a new game that we're playing, though, you convince everybody, even though I have never played the game before, I feel like if we're playing with other people, that you're just like, oh, Garrett knows exactly how he's playing this game. He's got a plan, and he knows what he's doing. And I'm like, I don't.
You're kind of like Jeff in that way, that, like, that's why you're my number one teammate, but. Like, because you could also apply for, like, the sports and stuff, except for basketball.
Except for basketball. I suck at basketball.
But, yeah, I mean, I just, you're just, it's that engineer brain that just is, like, wired to figure out, like, card games quickly, I feel like.
Yeah.
Like, strategy with that stuff. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway.
All right. Well, awesome. So, let's get into the Bible study tonight. So just a recap of where we are. I mean, I think I mentioned this in the last podcast. I think that Exodus 32 to 34 carries the most theological freight of all of the book of Exodus. Everything in Exodus has been leading to this point and is revealing to us now what the whole thing has been trying to do. And one of the key themes of the book is that God is making himself known. And both to Pharaoh and the Egyptians, but also to the Israelites, he's making himself known in a way that he's never been known before. He's never been revealed in this way before as so completely. And I think the book starts out with it being, you know, with Moses being at the burnished bush, and he's saying, "What is your name?" Right, and he says, "I am who I am," I think I mentioned last time is like it feels like that's like what kind of answer is that? You know, like what do you mean?
Like super helpful.
Yeah, and I think that's a really inspiring moment, and you know, a lot of people know that story, but I think a lot of what that's doing is it's trying to say narratively in the book of Exodus that you're about to figure out who I am. And I'm about to show you. Let me show you who I am to Moses. And he's going to reveal himself to Moses as the book goes on. And so through God's activities and the things that he's doing with Israel, with the Egyptians, and then whenever they get into the wilderness, all of these things, they're revealing God's character. And to the point where they get to Sinai, he's given them the law. He's revealed more and more of who he is to them. And now we've gotten to 32. In 32, we have, I think most people would say 32 is the golden, you know, like everybody knows it as the, you know, the idolatry of the golden calf, you know, and this failure of Israel. And it is that. But really, I think 32 through 34 is like, it's about God's response to people who betray him. And it's laying out what it looks like for, you know, for this interceding, like, how, you know, how does God deal with humanity, and what does all of that look like, and Moses and God having this dialogue of, you know, what are the repercussions of something like this? God just made a covenant with them. And now they've already broken it before Moses even comes back down the mountain. And, you know, it begins with Moses appealing to God's character. Instead of, you know, God's like, hey, let my anger burn hot, and I'm going to destroy them. I'm going to start over with you. And he would have every right to do that. They've betrayed the covenant. He would actually still be keeping his covenant to Abraham, because Moses is a descendant of Abraham. But Moses appeals to his character and saying, no, listen, like, you made these promises to Abraham and Isaac and Israel. And he's doing that to bring the people in and identifying with them and saying, no, these are your people. You brought them out of the land of Egypt. And so, and what would this say about you? What would the Egyptians say? This would be horrible for your reputation. And so he appeals to God's character and who he is and who he's learned, what he's learned about him along the way. To the point where God's like, he relents from his anger. Moses goes down the mountain anyways. And he deals with Israel and the repercussions of their sin and the judgment that ensues from that. And then he goes back up the mountain and he begins to plead again with Yahweh. Even though he's relented from his anger, that's not everything to this story. Just because he's turned away from his anger, they have not been reconciled to one another, Israel and God. And God says basically to Moses, like, you guys go off into Egypt. I'll make sure you make it, or I'm sorry, into Canaan. I'll make sure that you guys make it, but I'm not going with you. And Moses is like, absolutely not. You're going to go with us, like, or we're going to stay right here. You know, like, don't send me out from this place unless you're going with us. And it says a lot about Moses and a lot about what his desires are. Is not so much for the blessings of Canaan as much as the presence of God. He wants God's presence more than he wants Canaan, more than he wants the fruit of the land, I suppose, and all these blessings of God. He wants God's presence more than that. And Yahweh tells him, yeah, that last chapter, he said, okay, I'll do this thing that you said. And Moses, he says to him again of like, then show me your glory. And at the end of the last chapter, we got to the point where it says, that he's going to put him in the cleft of the rock, right? And he's going to come up the mountain, go into the cleft of the rock. And his glory is going to pass before him. And I think he actually says, I will proclaim my name before you. He says, when my glory passes over, I will put you in the cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I pass over. And I will remove my hand, and you will see my back, but my face will not be visible. It's actually in verse 19. He says, I myself will cause my goodness to pass over before you, and I will proclaim the name of Yahweh before you. And so, what we're about to get is the answer to the petition of show me your glory. And so 34 is going to cover that and say, what is God's glory? And what is Yahweh like? We're going to get that answer. So I guess we'll read this first section.
All right. The Lord said to Moses, "Chisel out two stone tablets like the first ones, and I will write on them the words that were on the first tablets, which you broke. Be ready in the morning, and then come up on Mount Sinai. Present yourself to me there on top of the mountain. No one is to come with you or be seen anywhere on the mountain. Not even the flocks and herds may graze in front of the mountain." So Moses chiseled out two stone tablets like the first ones and went up Mount Sinai early in the morning as the Lord had commanded him, and he carried the two stone tablets in his hands. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and stood there with him and proclaimed his name, the Lord. And he passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, "The Lord, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation." Moses bowed to the ground at once and worshiped. "O Lord, if I have found favor in your eyes," he said, "then let the Lord go with us. Although this is a stiff-necked people, forgive our wickedness and our sin, and take us as your inheritance."
Okay, so Moses, he tells Moses to cut some tablets again. If you remember, Moses broke the tablets whenever he came down the mountain. And he says, you know, just like the ones that you broke whenever you came down the mountain.
I love that part.
Yeah. It's just a reminder, like, you know, it was, there's a whole deal about written with the hand of God, and then you got down the mountain, got angry, threw it on the ground.
Yeah, it's like God, like, got really angry, like, relented to some extent, you know, and then, like, Moses talked him off the edge kind of thing, and then Moses is like, sees the same thing, and is like, okay, I'm breaking what God wrote in stone, inscribed with his finger, no big deal.
Yeah, which, I mean, again, if you go back to that narrative, it's like, he's doing that which Israel did in their hearts.
Exactly.
But anyways, yeah, he has that nice little reminder of which you broke, and he tells him to come up in the morning, and present himself to him, and you know, nobody else is supposed to go up, not even sheep, goat, cat. Make sure nothing's on the mountain. Everything's gonna die if it's on the mountain. So he brings you up to the mountain, and it says that whenever he's up there on Sinai, it says that the cloud descended, and it says that he stood there with him. So, like, I mean, God is, he's taking this. You know, I mean, and I guess we kind of got that what was the word, anthropomorphic idea. This, he's taking on a human form in some way. Like, it seems like he's standing there with him. He's talking about his back, you know, and like that you can't see my face and all of these things.
Yeah.
And so he, at the very least, it's trying to use terms that we can understand.
Yeah.
Whatever case, he's anthropomorphic. Emphasized, I don't know how you say that. That's a long word. Anyways, he's shown his kind of human. He's given human attributes.
Yeah.
And it says that he stood there with him and he proclaimed the name of Yahweh. So you have any thoughts on any of that before we get into the depths?
Well, here. I mean, I do, but I think you might want to get into the depths first.
Oh, okay. So, first off, if you were to ask, like, I think just in general, if you were to go and ask somebody, what is God like? I think that their answers, if you just went into a church and you said, hey, what is God like? I think they would use words like omnipotent, all powerful, creator. Redeemer, or they might say God is love. That might be one of them.
Yeah.
But I think in general, whenever we're trying to describe God, most of the time we use like words of power, you know, and words of,
Well, I think we do use forgiving though.
Yeah. I think we do. Yeah, sure.
But yeah, not to this. Yeah. We don't use this, level of description.
Right. Well, yeah, so I think This is what Peter Hinn says. He says, if a poll were taken of seminary students, perhaps pastors as well, and if the question was, what is God like? My strong suspicion is that many of the following attributes of God would be mentioned. Omniscient, omnipotent, sovereign, unchanging, eternal, creator, and so forth. Few would add to the list such things as prone to change his mind, argues with his people, can be frustrated, can regret past actions. Yet all of the latter attributes are just as scripturally defensible. Too often, it seems to me, despite our biblical literacy, we think of how God ought to be rather than how he has actually revealed himself. The biblical portrait of God is varied, and I do not deny that God is indeed all of those wonderful attributes we read about in systematic theologies. But what of those other attributes, those less marketable qualities of God that never seem to make their way into our systematic theologies, but which find constant biblical substantiation? We should not focus on God behind the scenes and thereby lose sight of the God of the scenes. The God presented to us in Scripture, or the God presented to us in Scripture. Scripture itself is what God has inspired to teach his people what he is like. What he says about himself must be taken into account. And so I just said, like, all of those things are true about him. He is, you know, omnipresent or all-powerful and omniscient and all of this stuff. But whenever we talk about what is the way that God describes himself, it's right here. Yeah. This is it. And so whenever God describes himself and what his attributes are like, it's this. Is that Yahweh, God who is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding with loyal love and faithfulness, keeping loyal love to thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, and he does not leave utterly unpunished, punishing the guilt of the fathers on sons and on sons of sons on the third and the fourth.
So I think this might be a good place for me to kind of give my thoughts on this.
Yeah.
Because just like you're saying, it's like, yeah, we kind of leave out the part like God is a punisher.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, sure.
You know, the more negative, well, I'll air quote negative traits that we don't want to think about as much are the things that kind of scare us. And something that I've been thinking about a lot with this lately is just how when we view other people, we don't like, we acknowledge that our like personalities and our attributes and our feelings are super complex. Like there is, I don't remember much from my freshman year of college just because that was a long time ago. But I do remember my psychology class. My professor would always say things are complex. He would say that over and over. He would say it every lecture. And just thinking about, you know, none of us are always like just one emotion, like just purely one emotion or one feeling. And it got me thinking about how we as people tend to accept that you can hold both joy and grief at the same time.
Yeah.
Like two very opposite feelings or emotions or states of being, however you want to talk about it. I think we can accept that somebody who has lost somebody or who has just gone through something terrible can still also hold joy in their life. And so for me, even though that's not exactly what we're talking about here, it still like shows me that God, we're made in God's image. He can hold complex, varying states of being as well. He can hold anger and love for his people simultaneously, just in the same way that like I sometimes hold anger and love towards my son, and very rarely my daughter.
The anger side.
The love.
I don't hold much love or anger for my daughter.
No, she's just been super easy so far. Knock on, where's some wood? We need some wood. But, you know, it's like I can be so frustrated as a parent, and yet also I would die for my child. And that's exactly, like, I'm understanding that more and more. Yes, those emotions, if like for the mind of a 5-year-old, Caleb thinks that if I'm angry at him, then I must hate him.
Right.
He doesn't understand the complexities of, like, human feelings yet.
Yeah.
It's like, it's too complicated, honestly. Right. And so it's like, I can feel frustrated with him and also love him with the most intense love that I've ever felt at the same time.
Yeah. And if that's true of us as God's image bearers, how much more true must that be of the God in who we bear his image?
Yeah.
That for Caleb, because I may think that he needs to be punished for something, does not mean that I lack compassion for him.
Right.
I feel extreme compassion. Like, actually, my compassion and my love for him is much greater than that needed immediate punishment in order to correct what he's doing.
Right.
And even so, that, and we've talked about this in the Minor Prophets, of like, even that correction is bound up. Even my desire to correct and punish when he's guilty of something, whenever he's done something that he knows he's not supposed to do, and I've told him he's not supposed to do it, that correction is always bound up in my love and desire for him to be who he can be.
Yeah.
And that he's better than that. And I know that. And so then whenever my correction comes in, it's bound up in my compassion for him. Yeah. And the same is true of God. And I love that. I think, like, you have just totally nailed that. I mean, just, like, you said that beautifully, and the holding grief and joy at the same time. Like, we know that this is something that we can do. We know this is something that we have in our own hearts. And so, just the same, it's like, these are not competing ideas. Whenever we read this of, like, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loyal love and faithfulness, keeping love to the thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, that's not at odds with the next statement that he doesn't leave utterly unpunished.
Yeah.
You know, that he does deal with that. I mean, the key is the juxtaposition of the two. The first is, you know, keeping loyal love to the thousands, to the thousands of generations. We haven't even, like, we've not even close to touched 1,000 generations in historical history of humankind.
Yeah.
And so, like, we're not even close to touching it. And so then the idea of to the third and the fourth, like, that when you look at those two things together, like, they're totally, it's just totally one way, it feels like, you know?
Yeah. Well, and just this has kind of come to my mind as we've been talking, it's like, like, Caleb got in trouble for something tonight, and at bedtime, unbeknowing to me, like, just, goes perfectly with this. He, you know, he's all saying, oh, you hate me, blah, blah, blah. And I said, no, Caleb, I love you, but I can't allow you to treat me and Daddy this way. Right. I can't allow you to do these things. And, you know, that's, like, very much, I think, what God's saying to us here is that, like, I love you so much, but I can't allow you to do these things.
Right.
It's just a more, it's not as simple of a
statement. Yeah. And just watch, I mean, just look again, these things are not, in this one chapter. Again, this is something that's been poured out throughout the whole story. Mm-hmm. And I think in these two, loving to the thou, or, you know, being slow to anger, and abounding with loyal love and faithfulness, those are being worked out in this narrative of, like, what does that mean? That he doesn't leave the guilty unpunished, but yet he has, you know, he holds this loyal love.
Yeah,
is worked out in the golden calf narrative of, like, they didn't get what they deserved with it. Like, he let that go somehow.
Yeah.
You know, you don't really know, like, in this narrative, it doesn't really tell you
and
how.
And I think I mentioned this to you the other day, of just, like, sometimes when I read stuff like this, of, like, he punishes the children, it, like, my mind, for some reason, automatically jumps to, like, eternal condemnation.
Right.
And it's, like, that's not necessarily, it's, like, it could, there's a wide variety of punishments. Yeah. I mean, like, and we just saw that they were struck with a plague.
Right.
You know, and I guess two two chapters ago, the end of 32, chapter 32. So, I mean, it's like that it's,
yeah,
I think we have a preconceived notion in our head of what this punishment looks like.
Yeah.
But that's like not even a fair assessment.
Yeah. But if we let the story tell us what that is, and we let the story of the Torah tell us what that is, this generation that comes out of Israel, or it comes out of Egypt, they arrive at Canaan, for instance, and they're one of the well-known stories, they send Joshua and Caleb in and the other 10 spies. And they come back and they're like, you know, Joshua and Caleb are like, let's do it. God's with us. Like, there's no way, like, he's with us. That's all that really matters. And then the other 10 are like, dude, there's giants in here. We're never going to take this place, whatever. And they cry out and they say, look, you brought us out here to die in the desert. And now our children are going to die too out here. Right. And so they turn away from God, and they become angry with him, and they, you know, they're just like, this is horrible. Like, what have you done to us type of thing? And God gives them over to what they've asked for, which is that they're going to die in the desert. In that moment, what he promises is that their children will enter the land. And so they're sinning against God, and they're not trusting him, and they're not, you know, he's led them through the wilderness at this point, and they're not trusting him, and he's going to keep them alive in the wilderness, but they're not going to be able to enter the land. So there's this aspect of, like, God is still looking out for them while they're in the wilderness, providing manna and providing everything that they need and being in and among them. But they're not going to be able to go into the land of Canaan, but he still blesses their children despite their sin with that. And he's like, hey, your children are going to go in. He kind of turns it on them and be like, no, your children aren't going to die in the desert. Actually, they're going to be the ones to take Canaan. Whenever you let the narrative kind of work it out, it's like, oh, well, what seems to make sense, is that, listen, sin affects everybody around us, mm-hmm. whether we like it or not, the things that we do affect the people that are around us. And it's the natural outworking of that. If I was a goober and I was doing a bunch of things, which I am a goober, but if I was, you know, if I'm doing drugs and stuff, you know, whatever, and I'm abandoning my family, is that not a punishment to Caleb? Did he deserve that? No, he didn't. But it's just, it's something that happens because of my terribleness. If, you know, the things that I'm doing wrong, he naturally is punished for that, even though he doesn't deserve it. And so it's like, this is a thing, it keeps it within the family. And besides, this is not a very individualistic culture the way that we are.
Yeah.
This is very family-based. And so if somebody in your family is doing something they're not supposed to be, it's the family's responsibility to say, bring this back. Like, we need to deal with this, and if you don't, you're just as guilty for it.
Yeah.
And so there's lots of complicating layers to that, but I think that I think we've dealt with that well, of just that how these things they're not really as intentioned as I think that we feel like they are.
Yeah.
And instead, again, it's this idea that Yahweh's first his inclination is to be full of compassion and graciousness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also with this thousands, keeping loyal love to thousands and forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but not leaving utterly unpunished to the third and the fourth. We've actually heard this before already in this book, and it came from whenever he gives the Ten Commands, and he's dealing with idolatry. There's a slight difference. I'll let Christopher J. H. Wright, this is from his book, Knowing God Through the Old Testament. He says, when giving the Ten Commandments, he had sanctioned the second commandment against idolatry with the threat that God visits the sin of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation, which effectively confines the effect of sin and punishment within the living family of the perpetrator in a multi-generational family culture. but followed by the promise of God's steadfast love to the thousands of generations of those who love him. Now, in the wake of the great apostasy at Mount Sinai, God reverses the order of that combination. So now he moves the thousand, you know, keeping loyal to love to thousands, he brings that to the front after the golden calf. He goes on to say, his limitless love is put first, and the unavoidable realities of temporal punishments and their effect on connected generations within families is included as a sad necessity. God cannot simply overlook sin indefinitely, but his choice is to bear it. That is, to carry it in forgiving grace. Moses asked God to show him his glory. God said that he would show him his goodness. Here is the definition of both. To know God is to know this God, the God of compassion, grace, love, and faithfulness. For Moses, knowing God meant challenging him in relation to his covenant, his name, and his promises, and finding that the way to stay God's hand was through God's heart, where those realities were eternally enthroned. You know, he makes the point of like that, look, whenever it came to this stuff, actually you see the change and the shift of what comes first here, which is the loyal love or the hesed. We've talked about that in Ruth. The hesed of Yahweh comes first now. And that's his default. He wants to go to that. And instead he wants to bear iniquity and transgression and sin. And that's where in verse 7, after keeping loyal love to thousands, forgiving iniquity, that's literally to carry. This is the word that was used for when he says, I bore you out of Egypt on eagle's wings. He carried them out of Egypt on eagle's wings. So the idea here for forgiveness, it's translated as forgiveness because that's what we understand. But it's all, somebody's got to bear the burden. Somebody has to, and it's Yahweh's preference that he bears that burden. How he bears that burden, that isn't worked out in Exodus. We don't have the answer to that in Exodus, of how he bears that burden. It's left open-ended. But that is, he tells Moses that is his preference. He would rather bear the iniquity, carry the iniquity of his people, rather than to punish. But there comes a time where that must happen. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's complex. God's complex just like we are. And actually the way that he describes himself is through things that seem emotional. You know, like I think a lot of times we just don't like the idea of an emotional God. But that's what we are. Like, we're emotional beings, and we love and we care, and we also burn hot, you know, like we get angry about things. And he does too. To say that he's slow to anger, which that word right there is long of nose, which is the idea of like whenever he burns hot, it takes a long time for it to blow out of his nose kind of thing, like this fire coming out of his face kind of thing. He does get angry, but it's best not to import what our ideas of anger are.
Right.
Let the Bible tell you what it is that he gets angry about. The first time that he gets angry in the Bible is at Moses in Exodus chapter 3 or 4, whenever he's at the burning bush. That's the first time in the Bible he becomes angry. And it's because the person, like Moses, is like pushing back on him and being like, I don't want to go. I don't want to do it. Send somebody else. And God, it says that God burns hot, and instead of like striking down Moses, he's like, oh, here's a solution to the matter. Here's your brother Aaron. He's coming. Mm-hmm. That's the first time he gets angry. It's best if we let the Bible tell us what it looks like whenever God becomes angry, and not import our ideas of what anger is, because we have very unhealthy. We express anger in a very unhealthy way because we're broken and fallen and all that stuff. So. Yeah.
Before we move on to, I guess, the next section, I just wanted to mention the Moses bowed down to the ground at once and worshiped. And it, like, his first response upon hearing who God is, mm-hmm. is to bow down and worship.
Yeah.
And I just think that that's like a really powerful image. And it made me think about how in the New Testament it talks about every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that Jesus is Lord. And this is just kind of like that moment where you just can't help but deny that, like, this is, like, this is God. This and he is who he says he is.
Yeah.
And so I just thought that was really a cool thing. And then also just Moses here does something interesting as he says, although this is a stiff-necked people, forgive our wickedness and our sin. Mm-hmm. Take us as your inheritance. And just, we've talked a lot about how it's like, your people, my people, like, it's going everywhere of, like, you know, who's who or whatever. And Moses, like, we've talked about how he's this intercessor, and Moses is taking on the sin of the people here. He is identifying himself as being one who sinned as well.
Yeah, he's identifying as if he was down at the bottom of the mountain mm-hmm. worshiping a golden calf. He's taking on that iniquity.
Even though he wasn't there, and he was angry about it too.
Yeah.
And so it's just kind of an interesting, I don't know, a little point. I guess we've gone back and forth with, you know, God will tell Moses, your people, you know, and then Moses will be like, no, 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 it's your people. And that each of these things have their own purposes, and they're just very intentional with their, Moses, like, has been, we've talked about this for the past few chapters of how intentional he has been with his words.
Yeah.
Which is ironic. Given where he started.
Oh yeah, yes. Well, good point. Like, he's been so well, like, for a guy that said that he can't speak well, he has spoken really well and interceded well for the people to the God of the universe, you know. It's like this encounter with God, whenever he sees him more fully, it's like he just can't help but worship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think whenever we approach God, That's just is something that naturally happens. As we come to know God deeper, we can't help but be moved to worship. And mm-hmm. And so that's what we see here.
So you want to read the next section?
Yeah, just a note, if you do want to get further into the individual words there for compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in loyal love and faithfulness, Bible Project put out a video for each of those words and going through what they mean and where they come from and how they develop throughout Scripture. I definitely recommend you look those up. They're fantastic, and helps you get a better idea. I mean, these things give you a better idea who God is, mm-hmm. And how it. I mean, this is the most repeated section of the Old Testament by the Old Testament. So we've already talked about it three times at least in the books that we've done. We talked about it in Jonah, Nahum, who else was it? Well, this is the third time maybe. But definitely in Jonah and Nahum, this is brought up as, you know, Jonah's angry about God being this way. And Nahum is the second part of it being like, hey, I can't let this go forever. And so both of those are working out what this even means. What is this like further developing God's character? So, all right. So let's move on to verse 10 here. And he says, and he said, look, I am about to make a covenant in front of all of your people. And I will do wonders that have not been created on all the earth and among all the nations and all the people among whom, and all the people among whom you are will see Yahweh's work, because what I am about to do with you will be awesome. Keep for yourself what I have commanded you today. Look, I'm about to drive out from before you the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Be careful for yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land to which you are going, lest it be a snare among you. Rather, you will tear down their altars, and you will break their stone pillars and cut off their Asherah poles. For you will not bow and worship to another god, for Yahweh is jealous, is his name. He is a jealous God, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they prostitute themselves after their gods, and they sacrifice to their gods, and they invite you, and you eat their sacrifice, and you take from their daughters for your sons, and their daughters prostitute themselves after their gods, and they cause your sons to prostitute themselves after their gods. You will not make gods of cast metal for yourself. You will keep the feast of unleavened bread. 7 days you will eat unleavened bread, which I commanded you at the appointed time of the month of Abib. For in the month of Abib, you came out of Egypt. Every first offspring of a womb is for me. All of your male livestock, the first offspring of cattle and small livestock, but the first offspring of a donkey, you will redeem with small livestock. And if you will not redeem it, you will break its neck. Every firstborn of your sons you will redeem, and you will not appear before me empty-handed. 6 days you will work, and on the seventh day you will rest. In the time of plowing and in the time of harvest, you will rest. And you yourself will observe the feast of weeks, the first fruits of the wheat harvest, and the feast of harvest gathering at the turn of the year. 3 times in the year, all your males will appear before the Lord Yahweh, the God of Israel, because I will evict nations before you and enlarge your territory, and no one will covet your land when you go up to appear before Yahweh your God 3 times in a year. You will not slaughter the blood of my sacrifice on food with yeast, and the sacrifice of the feast of the Passover will not stay overnight to the morning. The beginning of the first fruits of your land will bring to you will bring to the house of Yahweh your God. You will not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. And Yahweh said to Moses, write for yourself these words, because according to these words I have made my covenant with you and with Israel. Am I reading this last one?
Yeah.
And he was there with Yahweh 40 days and 40 nights. He ate no food and drank no water. And he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the 10 words.
All right. So this is kind of like an edit undo moment of like restart, refresh. It's like God is forgetting everything that has happened and he's starting fresh with the covenant.
Yeah, I'm about to make a covenant with you in front of all the people and I'll do wonders.
Yeah, and what, just before we dig into this a little bit more, maybe, I think it's so interesting that he's like, I will do wonders never before done in any nation in all the world. And I'm like, he's already done, like, he's already shown them so much.
Yeah.
Of, like, when you think about wonders and miracles and stuff like, you know, you think back to the plagues and the Red Sea, and like, I mean, just the story is full of, you know, providing food, hitting rocks with sticks and water coming out. I mean, like, just there's so many different examples. And so I just think that that's kind of an interesting thing, that it's like there's even more to come. But in general, this whole section is like a Cliff's Notes version of what we have already seen, the, you know, going back.
Yeah. It's a full, what this is trying to get to, I think, is a full reestablishment of the covenant.
Mm-hmm.
And that God has basically said, I mean, it really just kind of feels like the thing before didn't happen. And that he moves on and he's like, I'm going to make a covenant with you and we're going to reestablish this thing. And yeah, it is like a cliff note. It's supposed to, I think this is supposed to be representative of all of the covenant stipulations were, you know, they were written before, just without having to do it all over again.
Yeah.
And so I think it is a Cliff Notes version of it, and maybe hitting some highlights. I mean, what you can hear some of it, making sure you're not worshiping other gods. Maybe he hasn't so much forgotten. But it's like
there seems like a big emphasis on like no other idols, other.
Maybe I wasn't clear enough before.
Let me just emphasize.
If I wasn't clear enough before, don't worship other gods, don't make cast images, and make sure that you don't. I don't think that this is an idea of like. Well, I think the whole point of them separating themselves from the Canaanites is like, because it's like, listen, if your sons marry with them, then the wives are going to bring in their gods, and then your sons are going to give over into that, and then it's going to be, you know, it's going to be, they're going to be worshiping the gods of their wives and things like that.
I mean, it's why we emphasize, like, you know, like, you are who you're friends with. Like, yeah. You know, just kind of being mindful of who you're hanging out with, yeah. Because you're going to be influenced by them.
Yeah.
But I also think it's interesting, too, because it's like, they as a group were by themselves when they made the golden calf. So it's like, they didn't have, like, an outside influence to peer pressure them into make a golden calf. They mm-hmm. decided to do that on their own.
Yeah.
So, like, how much more would they be tempted if somebody was actually pressuring them to, yeah. like... Which, I mean, I guess you could say Aaron was pressured. But, like, generally as a group, you know, they didn't have any other outside
forces. Yeah, this is forces. This is, like, the youth group, like, youth retreat that you go to. And everybody's like, oh, yeah, this is awesome. And then you go back and, like, first Monday, you know, you're being influenced by the friends that you have. And they're, yeah. you know, like, it's real easy, like, when you're, quote, on retreat.
Yeah.
You know, to be like on fire for God and, you know, this is everything that I'm about. And then you get back into the real world with people and, you know, you're back to doing the things that you were doing. So, you're right. Like, if they've done it on their own, let alone
yeah,
imagine what it would be like when you're being influenced by yeah. other people that do this all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I that's definitely a huge emphasis on it. I think there's another big emphasis in here of the rest, of that you're gonna the whole Sabbath basically you're gonna rest, you know, even during harvest time and during, you know, whatever any of these times you're gonna be resting, and you're gonna do the feasts, you're gonna have these celebrations and stuff. Like, again, what a weird thing to, like, you know, we have such a negative connotation to commands, and it's like he's commanding them to hold
rest and celebrate.
Yeah, he's commanding them to rest, and he's commanding them to celebrate and to have times of gathering together. And even so, like, whenever all the males gather together to come before Yahweh, he's telling them, look, during that time, nobody's going to covet your land. And because that would be a big deal. Like, think about all the men from all of Israel gathering in Jerusalem, for instance. You're leaving everybody vulnerable. And what a trust move that must be.
Yeah.
You know, to say, like, all the men are going to gather here and we're going to say, you know, nobody's going to touch us. Because, why? Because Yahweh. You know, because of who he is. We know who he is and we're trusting in him. And so they would, you know, he's kind of telling them to do that. And that during that time, he's going to make sure that they're taken care of. So there seems to be a emphasis on that. And then it even seems like down to the weirdest one, you know, of you will not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. I think we talked about this before. I think this is the most repeated command in all of the Torah. I think it's maybe it's kind of the idea of, like, from the least of the commands that was given to, you know, from the greatest to the least of those commands are kind of in the mind right now.
Yeah.
But
I mean everything that I originally
exactly,
said.
Exactly. Yeah. He's not saying that, hey, all that stuff that I said in Exodus 20 through 24 is now out the door. Yeah. And now just these things. He's, again, cliff noting.
Yeah. So. And then I also, I mean, this whole 40 days and 40 nights, yeah, I kind of feel like, I mean, that's the same amount of time as he was with God the first time.
Yeah.
With the making of the original covenant. And I sort of feel like this might be, again, sort of like a test for the people of, like, what are you going to do? Like, because they might not have known how long Moses would be gone again. Because that's kind of seemed to be like, well, Moses is probably dead. Let's freak out and make a golden calf. Kind of seemed to be a little bit of the vibe.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of wonder if that was kind of a, okay, let's see how they do with Moses being gone for a while again. And they know the expectations. They know what they're, you know, agreeing to here. So,
yeah,
like, let's just kind of see what happens.
Well, and again, it feels like a full reboot.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's like, oh, you know, what in Loki, in the TV show right now, what, they just set, like, the time chargers or whatever, and they revert all the time back before the thing, before the Nexus event happened, you know? Yeah. So it's like, he's like setting a little time charger and it's like gone off.
Let's just back.
Let's just pretend the whole Golden Cap thing didn't happen again. So it's like a little time charger got set and Moses went back up the mountain. They're like, okay, now what's going to happen? Are you going to do the same thing or not? Yeah. You know, so that does seem to be it. And also just here, it talks about how he did fast. Like he went 40 days and 40 nights without food and water. And like, it feels like there's no chance that there's not some divine intervention for that he was sustained.
Particularly the water.
Right. Yeah, that he was sustained. And it may be just as a note before we read the next section, which is like, what kind of person do you think would come back down the mountain after not eating and drinking for 40 days? Like, what do you think they'd look like? You think they'd be gaunt, you know, like bone, you know, just your face would just be full, you know, just straight up like a skull.
Maybe pale. You know? Yeah. Well, I don't know. You're outside still.
Yeah. But like, sunburnt. You know, I don't know, like your hair's probably falling out, you know, like, I mean, at that point, your body's like got to be shutting down kind of thing. Yeah. And so that's kind of just imagine that would be the person that you would think is going to come down the mountain.
He's pretty old.
And he's also really old at this point. Yeah. He might be in his 80s at this point.
I felt like he was pretty old at the beginning.
Yeah, he was. But I mean, but this has only been a year since.
That's true. It feels a lot longer.
I bet he feels that way too. anyway, so that's just kind of idea of who you think come down the mountain. So we'll read this next section.
All right. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the testimony in his hands, he was not aware that his face was radiant because he had spoken with the Lord. When Aaron and all the Israelites saw Moses, his face was radiant and they were afraid to come near him. But Moses called to them. So Aaron and all the leaders of the community came back to him, and he spoke to them. Afterward, all the Israelites came near him, and he gave them all the commands the Lord had given him on Mount Sinai. When Moses finished speaking to them, he put a veil over his face. But whenever he entered the Lord's presence to speak with him, he removed the veil until he came out. And when he came out and told the Israelites what he had been commanded, they saw that his face was radiant. Then Moses would put the veil back over his face until he went in to speak with the Lord.
So what we expect coming down the mountain would be old man Moses, who hasn't been eating or drinking and would be very clearly just like showing all of his bones, you know, and all of his face would be gaunt. That's what we expected. And what we got was that he came down the mountain and it was just like he didn't even know that his face is shining, I don't know, like this idea of that, that Moses has this thing going on, like if the way that he looks that he doesn't even recognize, like he doesn't even realize that he's this way after being in, like before Yahweh for 40 days and 40 nights, he's changed. He's something different.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't even realize it. Like it's just something that happens to him because he's before Yahweh. And so it says that his face was shining, because of his speaking with Yahweh. I guess we'll just note that. Like, that's an interesting thing. Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I mean, that's just not what you would expect, obviously.
So his face is shining and then he goes down among the Israelites and you know they got to be like weirded out. Whatever's happening to Moses, they're just like, this is crazy.
Well, I just also want to say, thank goodness there was no shenanigans going on.
I think he's probably excited about that too. Yeah, no shenanigans. No, you know, he didn't hear sounds of jubilee, you know, going on down there.
Yeah.
It says, and Aaron and all the Israelites saw Moses to their amazement, and the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid coming near to him. So that's an interesting thing. So they see that they see his face shining because he's been before Yahweh, and then they become afraid, maybe that's even not the response that you thought. But maybe if we think about like what he's reflecting, maybe we start to get why they're afraid. Well, what have they been afraid of before? So they were afraid of the voice of Yahweh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was speaking on the mountain, and they were like, "Hey, go up and talk to him. Like, don't if he speaks, we're gonna die." You know, and so now Moses has had this intimate time with God, and he's starting to reflect His glory, and so I guess being, I don't know, there's something about that that they're starting to see Yahweh in him. Or that he is being truly the image bearer that humanity was made to be.
Mm-hmm.
He's starting to reflect that image, and instead they're instead of being like, "I want some of that," they actually become afraid, which is kind of sad. I think we get the feeling in this narrative that that's not desired. Mm-hmm. You know, like maybe that's not the desired outcome, but. Anyways, I think you have some good points on this of like what is it that's happening? What is Moses kind of emulating here?
Okay, so when I read through this, I was very kind of a little bit confused because it seems like, based on what we've read,
mm-hmm.
that this veil would need to be placed between Moses and God.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we read all about the tabernacle and how it is set up to protect the priests from just the radiant.
Yeah, the holy glory of God, the weight and power of who God is.
Yeah, so when I first just like casually reading through it, I was like, this doesn't really make sense to me. Like, why would he have a veil in front of the people and not in front of God? Because that seems to be where you would need that. And then as like Garrett and I kind of got to talking about it, and I had read some different things about it that I was like, some of it I agreed with, some of it I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But reminding myself that just like we talked about earlier in this chapter, Moses is an intercessor, is the mm-hmm. intercessor at this time.
Yeah.
And, just like he went to God on behalf of the people, he also goes to the people on behalf of God.
Yeah.
And so in this case, it's almost like, I mean, he's not God,
right?
But he is his representative at this time. And he's been like fully immersed in his holiness and glory.
Yeah.
That it's almost like this veil is there to sort of protect the people in the same way that the veil would protect the priests from God's holiness when they mm-hmm. entered the tabernacle.
Yeah.
And that is kind of.
Yes.
Where I'm at with
it. Yeah, so he kind of, it seems like he's kind of become this walking tabernacle,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of what we talked about, what the high priest was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the high priest is kind of this walking tabernacle,
mm-hmm.
and that he was God before the people and the people before God. And that he seems to be filling that role out. And like you start to see that and he's emulating the glory of God. And you're right, like the idea isn't supposed to be like Moses is God.
Right.
The idea is that Moses is becoming like God, not in the sense that he's becoming God, but that he's like starting to reflect his character. He's starting to reflect who he is. That's why his face is shining, because God shines and he's reflecting that. Maybe to try to help refine that a little bit. When me and you studied this together the other night. I was putting Kayla to bed, and he asked me the question,
oh.
"What was it? I forget what the exact question was.
Like, what is God's image, or what does it mean to be an image?
Yeah, it was like, what does it mean to be the image of God? Because yeah, I told him, I was like, you know, we're in the image of God. And he
this
was
kid,
like, well, what is
this kid
what
is,
does it mean to be the image
so
of God?
Smart.
And I'm like, okay,
this kid is so smart and asks like. The craziest
questions. He asked me, what does it mean to be blessed? And I'm like, that's a question I've been trying to work out like for a few months now of like, which I think I've arrived at what I think that is. That's for another podcast.
Yeah, when Caleb asked me these questions, I stumble through a response, and Garrett has these responses.
Well, anyway, so he like asked me what it means to be blessed. And then at some point we got to like, you know, we're made in the image of God and stuff. And I was explaining that. He asked me, what does it mean to be in the image of God? And so we had a Marvel, but me and him occasionally will read from this big Marvel book. It's got like all the Marvel characters in it. And so he'll make me flip through it, and he'll try to stall. And then whenever I'm talking, it's time to go to bed, he's like, I want to read this thing. Anyways, on the front of that.
Right before it's time for you to fall asleep, what does it mean to be the image of God?
Yeah. And so anyways, that Marvel book is sitting there, and I'm looking at it. On the front of it, there's right in the middle of it, Spider-Man. It's a Spider-Man swinging, you know, thwipping, whatever.
Thwipping.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, this is
thwipping. Anyways, and I was like, okay. And I held up the book for him, and I was like, Caleb, is this Spider-Man? And he was like, yes. And I was like, is it? Or is it an image of Spider-Man? You know, like, or is it a... Is it actually Spider-Man, Caleb, or is it just a picture? Is it a image of what Spider-Man looks like? And he was like, oh, okay. So it's like a... It's... You know, it's not actually like Spider-Man's not like in the book, you know, and so like he's starting to make that connection. And like, so just the same is like, we're not God. We are the image of God, which means that like through us, God can be made more fully known, but that doesn't make us God. And so that's what's happening with Moses here, is that he's starting to he's starting to emulate the image of God the way that we were meant to, and that he's coming to know God more, and because he's coming to know God more, he's able to demonstrate that to the people, although they don't want to see it. Mm-hmm. They become afraid of it, and they like want to veil it, and I think this narrative, I think, is really important, especially whenever you get to like the Mountain of Transfiguration for Jesus. When you get to the Mountain of Transfiguration, I think it's in all three of the Synoptic Gospels. But it talks about they go up the mountain. They go up the mountain. He takes Peter, James, and John with him. And it says that whenever they're on the mountain, that Jesus is transfigured, he's transformed before their eyes, and he becomes shining, and like he's got white robes or whatever, and he's radiant from head to toe, and it's shining out. I think that is very much and also key character, Moses and Elijah are there with him, up on top of the mountain, and I think one of the things that narrative is doing is showing Moses on the mountain talking with somebody who is shining with the full radiance and glory of God. And what it is essentially doing is saying that, you know, Moses was awesome. He was really being he was starting to reflect God's character and his attributes. He was starting to reflect that. But this guy, Jesus, who's now, he's at this top of the mountain, he is shining from head to toe. He is the true divine glory. Like, he is the one from which he's the one that Moses' face reflected.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's one of the things that those narratives are doing. And so this is really important to know whenever you go up the Mountain of Transfiguration, reading in the Gospels, that they're very much tying into this story and trying to get you to realize something about Jesus. And it's that not only is he similar to Moses, he's greater than Moses. He's the one from which Moses got the glory, that was shining the divine glory in the first place. Within this story, I think we've talked about this before, of that, God is, he's allowing his glory to be reflected out through other people, through Moses. He's not just, a glory hoard, he's wanting to share it. Yeah. Hoarder. He is about his glory. But the way that he becomes glorified is by sharing his glory. It's an odd paradox in the scriptures. Anyways, I think through what this is trying to show us is that Moses, as he's gotten closer, is making God more fully known. You have any other thoughts?
I don't think so. I mean, it's just, I don't know. The veil does kind of make me feel like maybe they're in the, just re-emphasizes that they're like in the infancy stage of their relationship mm-hmm. with God, and that like you kind of have to take these these baby steps of like they can't handle
yeah.
even just like a reflection of God, you know, much less God himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so
maybe their own guilt is still standing before them, mm-hmm. you know, where yeah. it's like, you know, we
too soon.
Yeah. It, yeah.
Yeah.
That I don't know that they're still hanging on to what happened with the golden calf, but it could be that. It could be that they're kind of being reminded of that. I don't know. When you see the goodness of God, you are readily reminded of who you are. Yes. You know? Yeah. And that's just a natural, yeah, whenever you put two, you know, I don't know, you put, you know, something that's holy and good up next to, you know, us dirty dirtbags, you know, it's like, it just is, it's going to be apparent. It's apparent to every person that comes into contact with God in the scriptures. Isaiah chapter 6, that's my prime go-to. Or Revelation, what, chapter 1. You know, anytime we come into to realization before the glory of God, we hit the floor, you know, and we're afraid. We're terrified because we're coming into contact with who this God is. And so it seems to me that maybe as we come to know God, more deeply, we come to, you know, we come to both recognize who he is, but also who we are,
mm-hmm.
More deeply. I'll just finish with this. I think this is something that Moses is recognizing. And I think what the people recognize, through this narrative, it's Carmen Joy Ives says this. She says, when you spend time in the presence of God, seeing him as he really is, you begin to see who you are as well, or rather whose you are. Knowing that you belong to him makes all the difference in the world.